It's the Electric Element edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, white or red poppies, electrons and electricity, what is blood, and where do all the elements come from? It's not where you think. Let's begin episode 273.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross sword, politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of star stuff. We are aware of the cosmos and know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others, and we have traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Hello, tis I, Don, your skeptical philosopher and political scientist. This week's wine is about Remembrance Day, and more importantly, what color should your poppy be? I've talked before on the show about the mixed feelings I get at Remembrance Day. I do wish to honor and thank those brave souls who risked their lives and often lost them to defend my country. Irrespective of the value of the particular fight, I respect the honest and sincere intent of their actions. On the other hand, often they were in fights or battles that I actually thought were wrong. The current bombing in Iraq is an excellent example. I also worry that by celebrating soldiers, by celebrating war, that we're sending the wrong message, and that's not something I wish to do. This has arisen a battle of ideas that has become more pronounced lately with the growth of the white poppy movement. This is sort of a counter to the red poppy drive, which is intent on promoting pacifism and peace. Before I give a take on this issue, let's first remember what are these poppies. The use of the poppy was first inspired by the World War I poem In Flanders Field. Its opening line refers to the many poppies that were the first flowers to grow in the churned-up earth of soldiers' graves in Flanders Fields. That's in Belgium, in Europe. The poem was written by our own John McCrae, a physician and lieutenant colonel, and he wrote it on May 3, 1915, after witnessing the death of his friend, a fellow soldier, the day before. The poem was first published on the 8th of December in a London-based magazine called Punch. In 1918, the American YMCA worker, Mona Michaels, inspired by the poem, published a poem of her own called We Shall Keep the Faith. In tribute to McCrae's poem, she vowed to always wear a red poppy as a symbol of the remembrance for those who served in the war. At a November 1918 YMCA Overseas War Secretaries Conference, she appeared with a silk poppy pinned to her coat and distributed 25 more to those attending. She then campaigned to have the poppy adopted as the national symbol of remembrance. At a conference in 1920, the American Legion adopted it as their official symbol of remembrance. At this conference, a French woman, Anne Guerin, was inspired to produce an artificial poppy commonly used today. In 1921, she sent her poppy sellers to London, where they were adopted by Field Marshal Douglas Haig, a founder of the Royal British Legion. It also became adopted in that year by veterans group in Canada, Australia, and New Zealand. Currently, the Red Poppy campaign raises about $14.5 million, and of those, each legion gets to keep about 88 cents. So that's a lot of money to help keep these legions do what they do and to help the people that I do want to support and honor and remember. Some say in protest, others say in contrast to the Red Poppy campaign is the new White Poppy campaign. I say new, well, the original White Poppy campaign is almost as old as the Red Poppy one. In 1926, a few years after the introduction of the Red Poppy in UK, the idea of pacifists making their own poppies was put forward by members of the No More War movement. Their intent was to remember the casualties of all war with the added meaning of hope for the end of all wars. The red poppy, they felt, signified only British military dead. However, they didn't pursue the idea. The first white poppies were sold by the Cooperative Women's Guild in 1933. The Peace Pledge Unit took part in their distribution in 1934, and white poppy wreaths were laid from 1937 as a pledge to peace that war must not happen again. Anti-war organizations such as the Anglican Pacifist Fellowships now support the white poppy movement. Those who promote wearing the white poppies argue that red poppies also convey a specific political standpoint and point to the divisive nature of the red poppy in Northern Ireland, where it is worn mainly by unionist communities. They chose the white poppy over the red poppy, often because they wish to disassociate themselves from militaristic aspects of Remembrance Day, rather than the commemoration itself. So I say recent. Well, the white poppy has had a resurrection in recent years. Most people who promote the wearing of the white poppy as a symbol of peace and a pledge for no more war also tend to buy the red poppy, that they don't see it as two conflicting ideas, but as sort of mutual support. One to honor the people, the other to promote the ideal. Now, I heard recently a veteran make a compelling comment about why he wears both poppies. Let's listen to his take on the issue.
Malcolm French served 25 years with the Royal Canadian Navy and at the time of his retirement was executive officer of HMCS Queen, the Naval Reserve Base in Regina.
Last year, I wore two poppies, one red and one white. This year I intend to do it again. Some claim the white poppy is disrespectful to veterans and to the fallen. It's a trumped-up controversy designed to have citizens outraged over trifles to divert attention away from the real disrespect meted out to veterans every day. Under the new Veterans Charter, ongoing pensions for wounded soldiers have been replaced with lump-sum payments. Veterans Affairs offices have been closed. We have now lost more Afghanistan veterans to suicide than were lost to enemy action. So why did I wear two poppies? And why will I do it again? For me, the red poppy represents the sacrifice of the fallen. The white poppy represents the hope for a better future, where young soldiers, sailors, and aircrew do not have to die. I'll wear two poppies because I believe that the two sides of the Remembrance Day narrative need to be balanced. Because I honor the sacrifice of veterans and their fallen comrades, I believe that the lives of young Canadian service folk should not be sacrificed lightly. I'll wear two poppies because I reject the antics of the professional rage artists who deflect our attention from real issues. But mostly, I'll wear two poppies to take a stand against the phony outrage intended to shame those who would wear a white poppy. If not for that, I doubt I'd have gone to the trouble of tracking down a white poppy. Just below my two poppies, I'll wear the medals I was awarded during 25 years of service in the Canadian Navy. Though I was never called on to face combat, I am proud of my service to my country. Much of the criticism of the white poppy came from people who never served. I have no lessons in patriotism to take from them. I know, because of recent events in Ottawa, this Remembrance Day may be more somber than others. The violence at the very seat of our democracy reminds us of why such sacrifice was necessary. As we approach Remembrance Day, we will be reminded again and again that those who served and those who never came home were defending our freedom. I agree. And I can think of no greater disrespect to veterans and to their fallen comrades than to self-censor on Remembrance Day of all days. I will not dishonor the sacrifice of the fallen by fearfully laying aside the freedom they won at such cost. That's why this Remembrance Day, I'll wear two poppies, one red and one white.
Well, that was well said, and I liked it. For those who are interested, at the end of the show, I will put up a bit of web wisdom of a quote debate about which poppies should be worn and whether we're sort of forced to wear the red poppies. But for now, let's pause and take a bit of a break.
After decades of decline, drowning fatalities have been rising dramatically in Canada since 2004. Most drowning victims had no intention of going in the water, and harmless situations can become dangerous quickly. This summer, if you're going out on the water, even if you're not planning on going in it, be water smart and be prepared. Here are some things you can do to reduce your risk of drowning. Learn to swim and swim to survive. If you can tread water for a minute, you can orient yourself, and if you can swim 50 meters in a pool, you'll most likely be able to swim to safety in open water. Most drowning fatalities occur within just 15 meters of safety. Wear a life jacket or personal flotation device. 80% of all boating deaths were people who were not wearing one. Take a marine safety course, and if you're going kayaking or canoeing, know how to get out of your craft if it flips over. Practice basic safety moves such as wet exits and self-rescues. Save the alcohol for dry land after you're done playing on the water. And never go out alone. For more information and more safety tips, go to lifesaving.bc.ca.
Okay, and we're back. Okay, this week is another informative set of five new things. So first of all, let's start off. Why is the sky blue and the sun yellow? Okay, there are, of course, a couple of incessant questions that Kit asks in the belief that you will have all the answers. And some of us would say, okay, just go ask your mother or your father or whatever. Others, though, have always felt comfortable that they knew the answer. And it was that light reflected in the atmosphere by water, water's blue, ergo, the sky is blue. Well, if this is what you say to the wee ones, you are wrong, kind of. It is true that water in the atmosphere is largely responsible for light being deflected or refracted. However, the fact that we see water as blue has nothing really to do with why the sky is blue. The light we get from the sun is white. Why then is the sun yellow? Well, more on that later, but trust me, for the moment, light emanating from the sun is white. When the light is refracted in the atmosphere, the colors are spread out, like a prism. Now, you might like to know how a prism works. Why is it that when I shine a white light into a prism, I get a color spectrum out of it? Well, it's all about speed, or more specifically, speed change. Many believe that light is as fast as anything can go, the cosmic speed limit, but that's not actually true. You see, the speed limit of the universe is the speed of light, but in a vacuum. However, how fast light is will depend on the medium it's passing through. Light does not always travel at the speed of light, but that's a segment in and of itself. For the moment, trust me that light speed is variable in that it can travel slower than the cosmic speed limit. So as light goes from air to a lump of glass, the prism, it slows down a bit. How much it slows down is a function of its wavelength. The shorter the wave, the greater the change. This change is visible in how the light is deflected. Longer wavelengths don't change that much and go straight through. Think of red, orange, and yellow parts. While the short waves, blue, indigo, and violet parts, deflect more. This is why you see the spectrum. All the colors are together as they enter, but are deflected at different rates and thus exit at a different point, ergo the rainbow. Now let's return to water. We have all likely experienced a rainbow effect caused by a lawn sprinkler, maybe even from a bottle of water on a picnic bench. The point being, water, like glass, can reflect light into the spectrum of colors. So in theory, all the light entering our atmosphere hits the water in the air, so we should see a rainbow everywhere. Well, we can assume that most light is pointing down, a line from the sun to the ground. This means the refraction is not equally spread out. Sorry folks, as pretty as a technicolor sky would be, it doesn't work out that way. So this downward direction means that the part of the spectrum we see is that which is on the edge, the blue part of the spectrum. Now, of course, the direct line analogy is not absolute. Ergo, the sky is blue-ish and not violet because we do see, if not consciously, all the spectrum. It's just that there's a statistical bias for blue. If you ever get a chance to see the chart of the sky's color, you'd see a classic bell curve, which is just slightly offset to the blue end. This is why we see the sky as blue. What about a red sunset? Or the yellow sun? Well, remember I said you should think of all light as traveling in a straight line from the sun to the ground. When you look at the sun, you are directly in the path of light. So if we remember what we just said about prisms, the least deflected is the red and yellow parts. Thus the bias is now towards yellow and we see a yellow sun. Good, but what about a red sunset? The red sunset is, sadly to say, an indication of air pollution. What, you might say? That turned darkly political pretty quick. And, well, yes and no. You see, another thing that affects the travel of light through our atmosphere besides water is other particles. These particles act like obstacles that deflect light. The shorter the wavelength, the more it is likely to be deflected. Now, this is usually not a major factor during the day because the sun is above us, and the amount of atmosphere it must travel through is relatively shallow. However, as the sun sets, it is no longer above us, but on Earth's edge, so it travels through a lot more atmosphere. Thus, the effect of these particles becomes more significant. Thus, sunsets tend to be red. The greater the air pollution, the greater the tendency to red there will be. Now that I've set some light on that, let's energize our next new thing. What is electricity? Well, the simple answer, electricity is the flow of electrons. Good, done. Let's move on. Oh, what? What's an electron? Well, the electron is one of the fundamental particles of the universe, along with things like the quarks. As far as we currently know, these are the most fundamental building blocks of matter, energy, everything really. Protons and neutrons, also part of our discussion, are what I would call penultimate forms because they are composed of quarks. So a proton is a proton because when three particular types of quarks bind together, they create or are a proton. If you looked inside a proton, you'd see these quarks. As far as currently understood, there's nothing inside of an electron. It just simply is an electron.
consumed by electronics in a year when they were not in use could power Whistler Blackcomb Resorts for 43 years. This Power Smart Play brought to you by BC Hydro Power Smart and CITR 101.9 FM.
And we're back. So we were asking the question, what is blood? So here's a trick question. We all know that every cell in our body has our DNA, a complete set of the blueprints for us, with one exception, that is our reproductive cells, which of course only have half a copy. Well, you may also know that there's another exception, that we actually have two sets of DNA that are us, so to speak. One set is our nuclear DNA, which is our blueprints. The other is our mitochondrial DNA. Why two sets? Well, at some point in our ancient past, our cells, the ones that control the nuclear DNA, was invaded, swallowed, or joined forces with another cell. Our cells provided material and security in exchange for these cells, the mitochondria. Well, they became our power plants. These guests, should I say guests? Sure, why not? These guests are fundamentally not us, but are independent creatures that have their own DNA and yet live within us. Okay, this DNA, unlike our DNA, is not transmitted via sex. This is a mix of two parents' DNAs. No, everyone's mitochondrial DNA is inherited from mom. Thanks, mom. This is why biologists can use mitochondrial DNA as a kind of genetic clock, because mutations in DNA occur actually on a sort of regular basis. And because this DNA is relatively speaking pure, the more mutations, the older the sample. It also helps to define our ancestry and heritage. Again, everyone's mitochondrial DNA can be traced back to the first mother. And thus again, using mutations, we can trace back our own matrilineal line of descent or ascent, depending on how you look at it. Okay, so now back to my trick question. What kind of DNA do we find in red blood cells? I'm going to give you a minute to Google that. Still looking? Well, as I said, it's a trick question. The answer is that there's no DNA in red blood cells, nor are there any in the white blood cells. Well, technically, there could be some in the white blood cells, but that would be the DNA of the invading host that is attempting to dissolve or digest. This question came up recently in a conversation I had and almost had the false sort of common knowledge belief that every cell of the body had DNA. Well, blood does not. If you think about it, it does make some sense. Most, all, cells that have DNA reproduce by subdividing. That is, old cells give birth to its replacements by a process called mitosis. However, some cells, like blood cells, do not self-replicate, but are made by other cells. In this case, blood stem cells found in your bone marrow. This then led me to sort of contemplate, what the hell is blood? It is far more complicated and fascinating than you'd think. There are various parts of our blood. Blood cells, red and white, platelets, and plasma. So let's start off easy. Red blood cells. We all know what these do. They transport oxygen throughout the body. They do this because of a special molecule called hemoglobin, which contains iron. This easily binds with oxygen, and you get rust. Well, not rust, but this is why fresh blood, blood rich in oxygen, looks red. Blood coming out of the heart travels in arteries and then returns to the heart via veins. This means that with one exception, the blood leaving the heart is oxygenated and the returning blood is relatively low in oxygen. You might think, oh, that explains why blood turns blue. After all, it looks blue through my skin. Then it's the lack of oxygen is returning to the hearts via our veins. Well, no, our blood is always red. So why do veins look blue? Well, the technical reason is due to the difference of color absorption of blue and red light between blood and our skin. That is, both the skin and the blood vessels are red. But because our perception of color is relative, the fact that the vessels reflect a little bit more blue light than the skin gives them a relatively bluish hue, irrespective of the fact that most of the reflective light is red. Silly brains. And this is visible mostly in white folk. Yes, this is kind of racism in that most of the color effect is masked by melanin you'd find in darker skinned people. I wonder if this is why the idea of royalty are blue-blooded is sort of a European meme. So that is why when you're cut, you don't see purple, which is what you would see if the blood was red and blue in reality. Side note, yes, blue blood is a European thing. Nobility did not go out and work, so they didn't get out in the sun, so they weren't tanned, and their skin was especially pale, thus amplifying the sort of blueness in their veins, thus the idea of blue blood equating to nobility is born. Anyway, red blood cells seem to have the machinery to do more than tote oxygen, but that seems that's all they ever do. They have a life expectancy about 3 to 4 months. We have about 5 million red blood cells per microliter, or roughly 25 trillion red blood cells. This accounts for about 1/4 of all our body cells. Compare that to white blood cells, which number about 7 to 8,000 per cubic milliliter. They account for only about 1% of our body, and yet these are the first and primary defenders of our body against invaders. And unlike red blood cells that are one type, white blood cells, also called leukocytes, come in 5 distinct varieties. Some are the large vacuum cleaner type we often see in cartoons. These essentially glob on to invader, bacteria, whatever, and attempt to dissolve it, the outcome of which is pus. Ew. However, there are some types of white blood cells that produce antibodies that help tag invaders to be killed. These are T cells, which are often heard about in diseases like AIDS, where when these cells fail, the body loses the ability to attack new pathogens. We become very vulnerable to that which would normally be harmless. There are other cells that help the T cells learn about new attackers, and some cause inflammation, and inflammation is an important part of the body's defenses. Although we see it as a reddening swelling, the body sees it as a way to concentrate white blood cells to isolate bacteria or whatever stimulated the inflammation. It expedites the transfer of invaders' info to the T cells to make new antibodies. Of course, we need our white blood cells most when we suffer an injury such as a cut. Another plank in our defense mechanism is our ability to seal wounds as soon as possible. This job is done by another blood cell, the platelets. We have, per microliter, about 250,000 to 400,000 platelets floating around in our blood, normally just taking in the sights. But if there's a disruption in the tissue sphere, if we get a cut or the like, these guys rush to the scene. They transform from smooth, rounded balls into sticky, tentacle-wielding carpenters. They do several jobs, but one job is to adhere together and with other cells to form a clot to stop the loss of blood. They also stimulate that inflammation response. Now, I said several jobs, and yet I've only mentioned two. Well, the actual mechanism and biochemical cascading that goes on to give you a simple scab, well, the body's a marvelous thing, and, well, that's a discussion for another day. Now, the majority of blood is not blood cells, but blood plasma. This is the fluid that transports our cells, as well as many other materials necessary for healthy living. So plasma is 95% water. But it is also the secondary communication systems for our bodies, the first being the neurosystems. And please don't be upset if I give primacy to the neurosystems. I am, after all, writing with my head and not with my heart. So, in the plasma, you find our fuel system, glucose. You also find what is called serum. That is a stockpile of antibodies that act as a sort of preemptive defense against infections. This is what vaccination does. It also transports proteins and electrolytes to ensure that all of our body has the material needed to maintain homeostasis. What is homeostasis? It's a $10 word for equilibrium, or basically a balanced body. You may remember I said it's a communication system. Plasma is also the primary way for hormones and other chemical triggers and signals to be transported around the body. When we see a lion, the brain communicates with our pituitary gland to produce adrenaline, which does nothing in the brain. But when our plasma transports it to our heart, our pulse increases and other effects happen throughout the body. Now, we know that all blood is red, that all life on Earth is based on the same primary building blocks. So you can't possibly have at least in the case of animals, green or yellow or blue blood, right? Well, yes and no. Yes, because a number of creatures have iron as the basis of their oxygen-carrying blood. That blood is not red. The anneal worms, their blood is greenish hue when it is watered down. In some other marine invertebrates, their blood, when oxygenated, turns a pinkish violet. And then there are members of the sea squirt family that have, thanks to a concentration of vanadium in their blood is a mustard yellow when oxygenated. Skinks have a green blood due to a buildup of bile pigment called bilirubin, which although called a waste, may actually have some anti-mutagenic effects. Science fiction has pondered the question, is how life evolved on Earth the only way for life to exist? As an example, must all life be carbon-based, like it is on Earth, or could it evolve somewhere else based on silicon? Why silicon? Well, chemically, it is very similar to carbon. It is just one row lower on the periodic table. Well, the debate on that question is sort of out there, but what about iron in our blood? Unlike the similarities between carbon and silicon, the element under iron is ruthenium, which is a bit of an oddball, and suffice to say, it would not even be remotely suitable as a substitute. But folks, I'm here to tell you that science fiction can be true. For those nerdy enough, you will know that Vulcans, Ree Spock from Star Trek, his blood is copper-based and thus blue. But not the royalty kind we hit upon earlier, but because of chemistry, oxidized copper turns a real blue. Well, on this planet, a number of arthropods, most famous and well-known, the horseshoe crabs, have copper-based blood and are therefore the true blue bloods of the world. It turns out that the blood of the horseshoe crab is very important to modern medicine. A component of their blood is used to detect bacterial contamination in medical supplies, something that calls for the milking, or maybe more appropriately the vampirization, of millions of horseshoe crabs every year. And according to most reports, only about 3% die from this sort of bloodletting, but some have argued that this number may be as high as 30%. Yet again, a discussion for another day. Okay, from the source of life to the origins of everything. But that will have to wait until after this break.
Subscribe to the Radio Free Thinker podcast and take it on the go and download previous episodes. Subscribe via iTunes or at RadioFreeThinker.com. Remember to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at CITRRFT. If you have any questions, comments, or thoughts to share with us, email at info@RadioFreeThinker.com.
Back. What is the origins of everything in the universe? That's our question. Many of us in the skeptic community remember the most famous and nigh spiritual statement of Carl Sagan, that we are all made of star stuff, that every atom that makes up our body at one time was made in a star some billions of years ago. Wow. Well, I hate to tell you this, folks, but the bugger lied to us. Okay, maybe that's a little harsh. It is true that much of what we are made of was once in a star, much of that created by a star, but there are many of our atoms that were not made in stars. So where do all the elements come from? This question came up when I was talking to a friend about what I thought was an anomaly, that the most abundant element in the universe is hydrogen, then helium, then carbon. But what about lithium, beryllium, boron? Why shouldn't they be on the list? And yes, I do talk about this stuff with real people. Well, at least I hope they're real people. They seem real to me. So that led me to ask, where is the element lithium created? First, for some background, the part I knew and where I assumed the story ended, and then discovered, well, I learned a new thing. The biggest creator of atoms in the universe, hydrogen and helium, well, they were created in the Big Bang. Hydrogen accounts for 74% of known matter. Helium for about 24%. The rest, 2%, is everything else. And just when we thought that was a lot of hydrogen, well, if we expand our look to all matter, atoms only account for about 12%, with photons and neutrinos accounting for about 25%, and the majority, 64%, being dark matter. That is matter that we know exists because it has gravity, but we are literally in the dark about every other aspect of it. If we remember that matter and energy are two sides of the same coin, so from this perspective, atoms account for only about 4% of the universe, with even dark matter being dwarfed by dark energy, which accounts for 72% of the universe. And yes, dark energy, like dark matter, is more a placeholder. We know of its existence because we can measure its effect on the universe, but have no idea what it actually is. Think about being pushed from behind. You have no idea what pushed you, but you know something pushed you. Okay, so I learned in school that after the Big Bang, the next largest factory for elements are the nuclear furnaces at the heart of every star. That through a process called fusion, stars create bigger and bigger elements. Fusion is a process where under sufficient pressure and heat, two atoms fuse into a new element, usually giving off a lot of energy in the process. So bodies usually start off with a lot of hydrogen. If massive enough, these bodies generate, via gravity and compression, sufficient heat and pressure to fuse hydrogen, sometimes called burning, but this of course is incorrect because burning is a very different context. In the context of nucleosynthesis, a $20 word for element creation, in this context, burning just means fuel for the nuclear fusion. Anyway, these young suns turn hydrogen into helium. When the hydrogen has been used up, the energy drops, the star collapses. This in turn increases the heat and pressure at the heart of the stars. This increase makes it possible for helium to fuse to form carbon. In turn, carbon burns to form nitrogen, then nitrogen burns into oxygen, and the process ends up when iron is created. At this point, it takes more energy to fuse iron than is given off by the fusion. Thus, the cycle ends and the star dies or collapses. So I grew up thinking that every element up to iron was produced in stellar fusion, and that every other natural element was created during supernova, the event where a sufficiently massive star collapses and then explodes in the galactic equivalent of a nuclear bomb on Earth. And in this process, all the heavy elements were created. So, from my learning, the elements were made from one of four sources: the Big Bang, stellar fusion, supernova explosions, and of course, there are those elements made by humans. Well, remember my question, where do we get lithium or beryllium or boron from? It's not made, apparently, from stellar fusion, and it's too light to be the product of supernovas. So, like any good nerd, when confronted with an unknown, I tried to make it known. It was during my endeavors that I discovered two things. First, there is another way elements could be made that I was not previously aware of. It's called cosmic ray spallation. This process made me laugh at my own narrow-mindedness. This process creates new elements, not by fusion, as I was thinking all elements were created by building smaller elements into bigger ones. No, it does it by fission. Fission is a process we use on Earth to generate nuclear power. It is the opposite of fusion, in that it generates power and new elements by splitting bigger elements into smaller ones. It appears that this cosmic process is the primary source of lithium, beryllium, and boron. Okay, learning new things. That's always a good thing. But I had to smack my head a second time when I looked at a periodic table that showed where the elements were created. It showed that thallium, silver, cadmium, even tungsten were created in large stars. Okay, you might say, so what? Well, remember, we discussed that nuclear fusion only works up to iron, and these elements are much, much heavier than iron. Iron is 26 on the periodic table, while thallium is 81. As it turns out, elements up to bismuth, element 83, can be made in stars. But how? And again, I'm stunned by my own narrow-mindedness. I stated that fusion ends with iron because it takes more energy to create the next element in the chain then comes out. Thus, the star's days are numbered, and that's all she wrote, folks. But it is like saying the only activity I can do is work, because that results in more money coming in than going out. But of course, that's not true. I do have to do enough work to keep my world moving, but I can also do other activities, like a hobby or going to the movies, where I do pay out more monetarily than I get in. So inside a star, beyond having fusion reactors, you also have sort of giant particle colliders, like we do here on Earth. We take a lot of energy and we smash particles together to create new ones. This same activity goes on in the star. Obviously, it's not the primary activity, otherwise the stars would collapse, but it's still a significant activity. So while the majority of the activity going on in the star is this productive fusion, you are getting this sort of secondary inefficient fusion going on that is the source of all these other heavy elements that seem counterintuitive to the health of the star, but they go on anyway. Oh yes, and here's a bonus thought. I just watched a show that asked the questions, well, how much water would it take to put out the sun? The sun is burning hydrogen. Water puts out fire. So could it be done? Well, there really is no amount that could put out the sun. Why? Well, because if we remember, a star is not burning in the sense of me burning marshmallows. That burning is a chemical reaction of oxidation. Water works because most fires we see need oxygen in the atmosphere to sort of liberate this chemical energy. However, the sun is not powered by chemical burning, but fusion. If oxygen is needed for a bonfire, gravity is what fusion needs to keep itself going. This means the more water you put on it, well, the denser the sun gets. This would only increase the rate of fusion. In fact, if you think about it, water is hydrogen and oxygen. And if gravity is the oxygen of a stellar furnace, hydrogen would be the wood. So really, you're just adding fuel to the nuclear furnace. So ultimately, you would only make the star brighter, not duller. But you would accomplish one thing. The more massive the star, the faster it burns through its fuel. So you would have shortened its life. So if you were to add something like 20 solar masses of water to the sun, that is 20 buckets of water the size of the sun, you would reduce the life of the sun from 5 billion to a few hundred million years. Okay, so let's lead to another obvious Bond villain type question. Could you kill the sun? Well, if you could initiate sort of a gravity wave or some kind of wave that sort of disperse the sun, spread it out over a large area, you would kill it. Because you see, it is only the concentration of matter at a single point that gives a star its superpower of fusion. Take that same mass and spread it around, and you stop fusion in its tracks. Figure out how to do that, and you could be a true stellar killer. So there you have it. 5, more or less, new things. Learning is always great. We'll be back after this break.
SpongeBob, you're wasting me precious carbon dioxide. I'm pumping it into the atmosphere, boy. Thanks to global warming, the temperature will soon go through the roof, and then we'll have an endless summer.
Why do you want an endless summer, Mr. Krabs?
So I can open me latest money-making venture, the Krusty Pool.
The endless summer does sound fun.
And profitable.
Fun and profitable. Big business does it again.
Unfortunately, for those of us who aren't talking sponges, climate change isn't quite as fun. Luckily, there are many easy ways for students to conserve energy.
If chargers for cell phones, cameras, and laptops are left plugged in, they continue to draw electricity even when not connected to the device. This phantom load can be avoided by unplugging electronics and chargers after use. A more convenient option is to hook electronics up to a power bar, which can be switched off after use.
For more energy-saving tips, go to www.bchydro.com. This message brought to you by BC Hydro and CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver.
And we're back. Okay, we're going to end the show with some web wisdom. We'll start with the promised debate about which poppy should you wear at Remembrance Day. After that, a quick take on how our skin heals itself after a nasty cut. It's not as simple as you'd think. And we'll close with the immortal words of Carl Sagan on how we are the cosmos's way of knowing itself. This is Don saying, eyes open, mind's on.
Jonathan, let's start with you if we may. We've had an awful lot of emails on this subject. Some are saying it's thought-provoking. I have to tell you, the vast majority keep repeating the word offensive. They feel that your report is actually offending their remembrance of loved ones in many instances, the people who made enormous sacrifices, and certainly one correspondent described it as the worst kind of gimmickry.
I think the important point to make out is there's been some rather mischievous reporting in some of the press today. We haven't produced a report, it was just an article in the Church Times newspaper. And what it said was perhaps we should consider wearing the white poppy alongside the red poppy. I've made my donation to the British Legion, my dad was at Normandy. What we are advocating really is a diversity and saying there's a situation in public life where the red poppy is the symbol of remembrance. However, there are other people, conscientious objectors, for example, who down the years have worn white poppies. And actually the white poppy dates back to the late 20s, early 30s, when the Women's Cooperative Movement, who had lost people during the First World War, asked the British Legion to print "No More War" in the middle of their poppies. This didn't happen, so the white poppy was born. And so this isn't a new fad, it's something that's been going on for years. And what we're saying is actually the white poppy could be a very good way of getting people to remember who are rather turned off by some of the patriotic associations, rightly or wrongly, that the red poppy has.
Well, what do the Royal British Legion think of that?
Well, we believe that the red poppy is an internationally recognised symbol of remembrance. And as one of your email correspondents said, it does an awful lot to raise money for the funds for the welfare of those people living today. The Legion would have no objection to people wearing a red and white poppy. People would need to be clear, though, that if they're making a donation to the white poppy, that actually they won't be making a donation to the welfare of soldiers. But certainly, the idea of freedom of choice is what those people gave their lives for those many years ago in the First World War and are continuing to do that today.
Are you not slightly concerned, though, Stuart Gendel, that there is almost, as Jonathan Barclay says, or at least the article in the Church Times says, a kind of political correctness that everybody in public life is now expected to wear a poppy? So that choice that you talk about is actually limited to some degree.
I don't believe it's anything to do with expectation. It's freedom of choice.
And are you sure about that, really?
We would say that everybody can make the choice to wear a poppy. We are absolutely delighted with the support that we get from all the echelons of society. We're really proud of the fact that we have this moment in the calendar year where people do recognise the poppy as a symbol of remembrance, and that we have a massive national turnout at the time of Remembrance Sunday, and people mark the two-minute silence in the way they do. We surveyed and about 1,500 adults very recently to ask them their opinion about remembrance, and over 85% of them said that they thought it was as relevant today to them as ever before, and 81% of people aged between 28 and 39 said they thought it was relevant to them today. So we're very, very pleased by that this message is taken up by a younger generation.
The largest organ in your body isn't your liver or your brain. It's your skin, with a surface area of about 20 square feet in adults. Though different areas of the skin have different characteristics, much of this surface performs similar functions, such as sweating, feeling heat and cold, and growing hair. But after a deep cut or wound, the newly healed skin will look different from the surrounding area and may not fully regain all its abilities for a while, or at all. To understand why this happens, we need to look at the structure of the human skin. The top layer, called the epidermis, consists mostly of hardened cells, called keratinocytes, and provides protection. Since its outer layer is constantly being shed and renewed, it's pretty easy to repair. But sometimes a wound penetrates into the dermis, which contains blood vessels and the various glands and nerve endings that enable the skin's many functions. And when that happens, it triggers the four overlapping stages of the regenerative process. The first stage, hemostasis, is the skin's response to two immediate threats: that you're now losing blood, and that the physical barrier of the epidermis has been compromised. As the blood vessels tighten to minimize the bleeding in a process known as vasoconstriction, both threats are averted by forming a blood clot. A special protein known as fibrin forms crosslinks on the top of the skin, preventing blood from flowing out and bacteria or pathogens from getting in. After about 3 hours of this, the skin begins to turn red, signaling the next stage, inflammation. With bleeding under control and the barrier secured, the body sends special cells to fight any pathogens that may have gotten through. Among the most important of these are white blood cells, known as macrophages, which devour bacteria and damaged tissue through a process known as phagocytosis, in addition to producing growth factors to spur healing. And because these tiny soldiers need to travel through the blood to get to the wound site, the previously constricted blood vessels now expand in a process called vasodilation. About 2 to 3 days after the wound, the proliferative stage occurs, when fibroblast cells begin to enter the wound. In the process of collagen deposition, they produce a fibrous protein called collagen in the wound site, forming connective skin tissue to replace the fibrin from before. As epidermal cells divide to reform the outer layer of skin, the dermis contracts to close the wound. Finally, in the fourth stage of remodeling, the wound matures as the newly deposited collagen is rearranged and converted into specific types. Through this process, which can take over a year, the tensile strength of the new skin is improved, and blood vessels and other connections are strengthened. With time, the new tissue can reach from 50 to 80% of some of its original healthy function, depending on the severity of the initial wound and on the function itself. But because the skin does not fully recover, scarring continues to be a major clinical issue for doctors around the world. And even though researchers have made significant strides in understanding the healing process, many fundamental mysteries remain unresolved. For instance, do fibroblast cells arrive from the blood vessels or from skin tissue adjacent to the wound? And why do some other mammals, such as deer, heal their wounds much more efficiently and completely than humans? By finding the answers to these questions and others, we may one day be able to heal ourselves so well that scars will be just a memory.
The lives and deaths of the stars seem impossibly remote from human experience, and yet we're related in the most intimate way to their life cycles. The very matter that makes us up was generated long ago and far away in red giant stars. A blade of grass, as Walt Whitman said, is the journey work of the stars. The formation of the solar system may have been triggered by a nearby supernova explosion. After the sun turned on, its ultraviolet light poured into our atmosphere, its warmth generated lightning, and these energy sources sparked the origin of life. Plants harvest sunlight, converting solar into chemical energy. We and the other animals are parasites on the plants, so we are, all of us, solar powered. The evolution of life is driven by mutations. They're caused partly by natural radioactivity and cosmic rays, but they are both generated in the spectacular deaths of massive stars thousands of light years distant. Think of the sun's heat on your upturned face on a cloudless summer's day. From 150 million kilometers away, we recognize its power. What would we feel on its seething, self-luminous surface, or immersed in its heart of nuclear fire? And yet, the sun is an ordinary, even a mediocre star. Our ancestors worshiped the sun, and they were far from foolish. It makes good sense to revere the sun and the stars,
because we are their children. We have witnessed the life cycles of the stars. They are born, they mature, and then they die. As time goes on, there are more white dwarfs, more neutron stars, more black holes. The remains of the stars accumulate as the eons pass. But interstellar space also becomes progressively enriched in heavy elements, out of which form new generations of stars and planets, life and intelligence. The events in one star can influence a world halfway across the galaxy and a billion years in the future.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Free Thinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com.
and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the stars. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rise. A morning filled with 400 billion suns. The rising of the Milky Way. The cosmos is full.
Hello, it is now the top of the hour on CITR 101.9, and you are listening to Zulu Anthems with your host, myself, DJ Mac Daddy, bringing you the freshest hip-hop from Oakland to Sactown, the Bay Area, and back down. This is my first time DJing on the radio.